Have another drink.
Okay.
It's a warm beverage on a cold day.
It is a little cold today.
It is. It's rainy here in this. Well, not in the studio. That would be terrible. But it's rainy here in the Corn Belt. It's been a rainy spring. We're recording this in late April because you spent, or early May, because you spent late April on the road, Josh Bittner. This is the latest edition of the MTM podcast. I'm Paul Yeager. That's Josh Bittner on the other side of the microphone. And we had a busy week where it was just Dave Miller and I holding things down. We were kind of lonely. You guys were all on the road. We had one East, one Central, and one West. You were the West. Why did you look at going to the West? You got two stories out of it. Was that a geographic choice or story choice that took you out there?
Well, I know that those other guys were going to those other places, so I wanted to get as far and away from them as I possibly could.
Is that what the restraining order said?
Yes, yeah, that's... no, we had this set up for a while. I had been talking to Washington State University since probably... maybe even December of last year, but we had a conference, phone conference in January about doing a story. I came across some information about a program that they're working on to use mushroom extracts to combat bee colony collapse disorder.
Mushroom extracts, okay.
Yes, yeah.
What does that mean? What's mushroom extracts?
Well, all of it, it's all kind of a long explanation, but colony collapse disorder.
Sure.
Which we're well, we've heard of.
Bees, there's fewer bees. Yeah. There's not as many places where they're at.
There are 61 different factors that could be involved in this thing. So it's this just kind of this enigma, this real shrouded, you know, peeling back the layers of the onion to get at the problem. Well, some of these, they found that there are compounds in mushrooms that inoculate bees against a couple of different viruses that contribute to colony collapse disorder. And it was observed by a mushroom grower on the eastern side of, or I'm sorry, on the western side of Washington. And he partnered with Washington State University. And so they had been working on a couple of different fungal related things to inoculate bees. So what we did was we flew into Spokane and then we drove to Ephrata, which I finally am pronouncing it correctly.
How do you spell that?
E-P-H-R-A-T-A.
Ephrata.
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 Yeah.
Okay.
But I kept wanting to call it Ephrata, and they said in Pennsylvania it's Ephrata. And then also I think maybe you and Phil, too, one of the videographers, said that that's biblical, too. And then Steve, who knows everything about history, I swear, he even knew that it was the name of a neighborhood in Jerusalem.
Hmm.
No, it was a neighborhood in Bethlehem when Christ was born. Was
yes.
Ephrata.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really boring down into, I didn't know that. But anyway, so it's not pronounced the way that it is in some other places.
How big is this town?
It wasn't, I don't know what the population was. It wasn't too huge. We stayed at the Best Western. I think that was the only hotel in town.
All right. So you know, 5,000 people, 4,000
yeah,
people.
Yeah. Nice little town.
Okay.
Know. We were only there briefly, but we went out there to meet the beekeepers. The two brothers were, Steve and Tim Hyatt, second generation beekeepers. And, they've got some brothers in California, I believe, too, and they maybe some other places, but they do have some in California. Anyway, they move the bees all around. Parents did it, too. They move them up to Washington to pollinate. They move them down to California to pollinate almond orchards up to Washington for apples, pears, other things like that. And then eventually they end up in North Dakota, and they make honey for the rest of the year then. So they live in about three different places throughout the year, so these guys are constantly moving. So we went out with them to kind of talk to them about their industry and stuff. They have had contact with Washington State University about this as well. So, but we went up there, put on the full bee suits and everything like that. We're surrounded by bees as they checked the hives, and they were filling them with kind of a sugar water.
Is that the steamy thing that you always see that they do, or is that something different?
That's smoke.
That's smoke.
And that's to just basically to get the bees to chill out. so that they can start pulling those different plates.
You're mixing your stories, Josh, of the smoke to chill out a previous trip. Sorry. It was a little too easy right there.
That's funny.
So they're using sugar water. What's the what's that sugar
water
for?
It was like a syrup. Oh, because they didn't have enough things to pollinate and then make honey right there, so they fed them this, this kind of syrup mixture.
Okay.
In the meantime, to bridge the gap to that time. They transport the bees all over the place, and we shot some of that too. But they have to do it at night because the bees come back to the hive then, and they're calmer because they're relaxing, I guess, for nighttime.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when they move them. If they move them during the day, the bees would try to come back to where they left, and then they would never find the hive. And so, yeah.
Kind of like in the Harry Potter world when they leave towards the in the last couple of movies and they get outside the bubble and they can't find Ron. No, a little too far. All right, I'll pull back. Sorry. No, but it happens.
My son's a huge Harry Potter
yeah,
fan.
He'll know.
I haven't seen all of them, though.
So when they move them from California to Washington to North Dakota, are they how many bees are we talking? Is this like the back of a pickup truck? Are they taking a semi? I don't know how they do that.
Well, when they drove around, when we followed them, we didn't get to follow them the entire night because it just ended up being too dark. So you're trying everything that you can to...
Oh, so you're saying they move them day by day or every 3 days or something from different parts of even that state or neighborhood...
Like about every two weeks,
okay.
They said it'll take to pollinate everything in an orchard. So after a couple of weeks, then they move them to another place. They're in Washington locally, but then yeah, different times of the year they'll take them down to California because they'll be pollinating in a little bit different times, I suppose. So do the apples, then go do the almonds, then go to North Dakota and.
And then from state to state, do you know how big of an air, what it is they're moving them, how they're transporting them? And
they do them on a semi, but I don't know if they do them any. What they were doing when we were there, we're putting them all, they're all on pallets, so they have a forklift, and they just put them on a flatbed trailer. And they stacked them, they would have been higher than the cab, and filled it by the time they were done. But since it was dark, we weren't able to hang with them. Then there was a car accident on this road, and so traffic stopped. And so we just ended up getting out of there
mm-hmm.
because it just didn't work to keep going. They would fill that thing up. And it was interesting. But, I mean, there's only so much you can do where you're, like, shining the headlights on something to get the shot. After
right.
a while, it just doesn't.
Looks all the same.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how many bees are we talking? When you're talking this pallet and it's stacked as high as the cab, is this a million bees, 2 million bees?
I don't know if they would be that many.
Okay.
Definitely hundreds of bees, maybe thousands of bees. I don't have the exact number on that. I would have to. That's a question I didn't ask.
Just curious. It's just a question that's been buzzing in my brain.
Right.
So
I tell you what was cool was being amongst all the bees while they were opening up the hives and doing all that. So we had all the safety gear on and everything, but they're just buzzing all around you. So you've got a couple of shots where you just shot the sky, and all you just see is bees just zipping all over the place, and the sound. And it was
great. Okay, so how would you describe the sound?
Just a lot of buzzing, I'm not going to imitate it.
Oh, okay.
you can probably creep some Foley in here later.
We have, but Steve has audio of it that we'll be able to hear. And that, give me more B sound, B on channel 2. Bring it up a little bit
Lots
more.
Lots of B roll.
Okay. Yeah. That was, we could really just,
pretty sweet, huh?
We could sting a lot of comments out of this one.
Oh, yeah.
Do it Gorley style. So colony collapse is something that we've known about for what, 10 years? We've been watching this for 5 years? It seems like it's longer than that.
I think that they first heard about it 20 years ago or more, but it had accelerated in the past 10, I think. They talked about it a little bit more, maybe even 15. So it's been around for a while, but yeah, it seems to be getting worse. So... it seemed like an interesting story to do with the mushroom extracts, which was, something different.
Yeah.
So we got to go out to a forest and shoot some mushrooms and
so now,
shot some of the extracts. Oh, I got a cool one for you, Paul.
Okay.
They At Washington State University, they are preserving bee genetics in case there is an apocalypse for bees. They can repopulate. So they store bee sperm in liquid nitrogen tanks, and we wanted to get a shot of them pulling it out of there. So I clamped the GoPro onto the bottom of this cage, shoved it down into the liquid nitrogen, and then had them pull back up on it. So all you see is just this bubbling, kind of boiling, really cold, and it pops up through there, and you see all the mist and everything at the top of it. It's round, the opening, and then you just see the scientist's face as he's pulling it out of there, and matched it up with the shot from Steve's camera. But that was pretty neat, and I had to show everybody there, and they all loved it. So
I was thinking you were going to say you dropped the GoPro into the liquid nitrogen, and they bumped the side, and the whole thing shattered. That would have been fun.
It did, but then like Terminator 2, they all turned into little pools and reformed. So it was that's what happens when you get the high dollar model.
I suppose that's good money spent there. When you're in the bee suit and you're buzzing around, you've got, I mean, everything is like tape shut and gloves shut. So you're not able to really operate like your phone, because your phone is
makes
a fingerprint.
Hard to pick your nose.
Yeah, it makes it hard to pick a nose and things like that. I mean, but Steve's still able to operate the camera. Were there other challenges of flexibility and mobility of you trying to capture that moment?
It wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. I took that Atmos Shogun monitor with us because I was going to record off of microscope, which we got some great shots of bees under a microscope, but I also brought it as a second monitor to plug into his camera and just kind of stand back and make sure that he had things in focus, mm-hmm. because you're shooting through that netting,
right?
And it actually was pretty good. All the stuff would look great. I didn't even really have to do that. So the challenges of it are just sort of getting used to. I think my suit was maybe a little bit too small, so I was kind of
cramps
a little bit
in
here. Yeah, so
yeah.
But I mean, it was really kind of neat to be amidst all of that.
Mm-hmm.
You had like little fasteners to keep everything, and we had like extra sleeve pieces, so you'd put on a glove. You don't want to wear black gloves; they hate the color black. Apparently, they'll
bees
attack
do.
It. Yeah, yeah. And of course, we both had black gloves.
Sure. Hazing.
Standard TV.
Yeah.
So we get to borrow some from them, but then you have this sleeve piece, which they call the gauntlet, which was just sort of makes it sound cooler. You know?
Right.
But it's basically elastic on two sides, and it's an extra sleeve piece, so it keeps them from coming in here. You're already fastened down with the glove, but then you put this over the top of it and then up here so they don't get in your sleeve anywhere there, too. So
how far do you have to go until the bees are no longer around you that you're able to take off your suit? I mean, 10 feet, 100 feet?
Oh, maybe 25 feet where you really, you know. And those guys, they didn't even have, like I had the full suit on. Those guys just had it over their shirt. They didn't have, I mean, they didn't have bare skin exposed. They had long sleeves and stuff, but they were just like, they're all right. Yeah. You know, they're.
So
you're
talking about this mushroom extract. I guess I haven't flushed that one out as much. So Colleen went on a trip where she talked about mushrooms in a place in Pennsylvania that grows mushrooms.
Yeah.
So is the extract like a liquid that is pulled from the mushroom, or are we talking like bits and pieces of a specific kind of mushroom?
So it's the mycelium, and it's polypores in the mycelium, and I need to refer to my interview before I go any further because I'm going to sound like a complete idiot who doesn't know what he's talking about. I can't throw out all the terms to you, but yeah, they eventually process it and it's a liquid,
okay.
And then they put it in there. But it's from wild mushrooms growing in the forest on the side of trees. It's not the farmed kind that she had. Mm-hmm. There were the white mushrooms.
Yeah, there was different varieties.
Okay.
But yeah.
There is a place where they grow them in Seattle, too, and that guy was the partner that kind of started it, but we weren't able to – he's really busy, so we weren't able to mm-hmm. – busy as a bee.
Busy as a bee.
We weren't able to connect with him.
You weren't able to buzz over there and get video of that?
No. And it presented challenges because we flew into Spokane,
right,
and we would have to either switch and fly to Seattle and drive, or still fly to Spokane and drive – traverse Michigan back and forth
Washington.
Two times.
Could go to Michigan. That's really that's a long way to go to get to Seattle.
Was Colleen in Michigan? I don't know where Michigan came from.
No, we haven't. It's been a little while. The Angie Setzer is who we talk about in Michigan.
Well, I don't know where Michigan came from.
That's all right. It's a mitt. Let me drink some more protection for your glove. Anything else?
And Mitt Romney's father was a governor there.
Oh, I thought you were going to say beekeeper or something.
No, but it was the mitt. So, no, it is the mitt. And actually, I was born in Michigan in the Upper Peninsula, so it's not part of the mitt.
Right. It's the UP.
Yeah. I'm a Youper.
But
only lived there for like 2 months, and then we moved to Omaha. So,
but Michigan, when you make it big and famous, they're going to claim you as native
you think
son,
so?
Josh Bidner. All right, anything on the college?
Don't hold your breath, folks.
Anything else on the bee story that you want to hit us with?
We shot in an orchard as well, so lots of cool shots of flowers opening up and blooms and bees getting in there, and then some of the Cascade Mountains in the background, and did an interview with the orchard guy there. So both of those brothers we talked to, and then the orchard, and then the folks at Washington State University were great. Nick and Jennifer we talked to, and then there was also Brandon and Steve. They were fantastic and great interviews, and they had some hives there too, and then we shot some of the lab stuff, and that's how I got some of that stuff under the microscope.
Okay. And so, is this the group that has somebody that's watched this program for a while, or was that on the other story?
That was the other story. Okay. So the other story was we're right on the edge of Washington and Idaho there, so I was like, oh, okay, shoot something in both states and kind of have a little bit more reach, Well, I kind of reached out to the University of Idaho, and then we found out about this agricultural commodity risk program that they have for their students. So essentially, we have a room full of market analysts, young junior market analysts that we might have for market-to-market's discussion segment, all talking about the factors going into the market and how prices are being affected, and then they can make trades, and they actually do some real trades as part of the program. So it was really interesting to go over there and do that. But yeah, Norm Ruhoff, who is the professor that runs it, he's from that area, and apparently Market to Market used to be on the Spokane station. So he had known of Market to Market for a long time. But then he lived in Omaha for 2 years, I think in the 80s, and worked for DTN. So he'd been watching Market to Market for a long time, so he had a lot of familiarity with the show, and he was like, oh, yeah, Chet Randolph, Mark Pearson, Mike Pearson, Delaney. He knew all the hosts and analysts that he'd seen for a long time, mm-hmm. too, as well. So that was pretty cool, And we actually asked him a question about Market to Market and how long he'd watched it, and maybe we can give that to our promotions people or something, because that's just kind of a neat testimonial,
And he watches it via the YouTube channel now.
He watches it online now, yeah.
Which anybody can do at any time, Friday afternoons, evenings. It sometimes appears there before it does on your television. I guess that's a little cross-promotion for us. Now, this is about ag risk.
Maybe we can get on the air back in Spokane.
We'd love to. If you listen to us in that area, contact the local station. Say, gosh, I wish he'd bring back Market to Market. We'd love to be out there. Ag risk management. From what you know about what you do on this show, is there anything that they're teaching in a different part of the country about risk management than what you hear on a regular basis here?
They said that was the only program quite of its kind in the country. There are some other ones. I think maybe Virginia had one, and for some reason Illinois keeps sticking to my mind, but I think I'm mixing it up with the professors at Washington State had come from Illinois. So I think Virginia was one, though. I can't remember the other one. But, yeah, they said the only one quite like its kind in the country, which was very interesting. So, and by the way, beautiful campus up there, beautiful area.
And that's in what town again?
Moscow.
Moscow.
Not Moscow, Moscow.
Moscow.
Yeah, which I thought Moscow was how the Russians said it and that Moscow was how it was said, like Moscow, comrade, Mm-hmm. But I guess I don't know anything. So anyway, they call it Moscow in Idaho. And then whatever they call it in Russia, I don't know.
Okay.
But anyway, I was really looking for some novelty stuff there that played on the whole Moscow thing, and couldn't really find any. I was kind of disappointed by that.
Well, they're probably over it.
I suppose they probably are.
You know, you know, people, outsider coming in. Yeah. He wants to call me comrade.
Real funny. Yeah. Okay, buddy.
They're the U of I.
They are. And the head of the Idaho Wheat Commission is involved with this program as well. And they want to do an internship with some of these kids, too. And these kids already have jobs, too. Cole was one of them. He's headed out to Norfolk, Nebraska. Justin was another one headed to Fargo. And then Colton Bailey were two other students that we talked to as well. And off the top of my head, I think Colt was going back to the family farm in Idaho. And Bailey was going to work for a bank, but I can't remember where. I think it was also in Idaho. But anyway, I just wanted to say something about the kids. But I kind of derailed my train of thought there. What did you ask
me? Well, I was asking if they – I think I'll ask it again when we get to it better. So this program is – you called them junior analysts. I mean, they're not juniors in college. They're almost ready to have jobs, right?
Oh, no. Yeah, no, they're graduating. Correct. Call them juniors because of our – yeah.
I totally get it. I totally get what you're referencing. The Idaho Wheat Commission is involved in this.
Yeah.
What is their role?
Oh, well, the head of it, Bill Flory, he's a graduate of there, and they didn't have that program. He was actually a business graduate, I think, from the 80s or 70s. They didn't have that program when he went there, and so he was very intrigued by it because he's a farmer, and he uses those strategies in his business. And so he really liked to see the students learning that kind of stuff. It was kind of neat because we were trying to figure out how to shoot this because we went and shot the classroom and they did sort of a mock deal. And because it was dead week there. So luckily we got them to show up, which was awesome. They were great doing that. And when Mr. Flory came up, they met him for lunch, but we were trying to figure out, we wanted to do an interview with him, but we're trying to figure out because his farm was too far away to go shoot B-roll there and shoot an interview there. So they had like a little wheat field, emerging wheat on campus in a little barn. So we kind of scoped that in another place. And Carly, who was their media communications person, was fantastic, really great to work with. But she kind of scoped these places out and took us out to them. And we're kind of like, okay, well, maybe we'll do this one. But first we all went to lunch. And so that's where he met the students. And so we're kind of like finishing with lunch and then they start kind of talking shop. So Steve and I are kind of sitting there going, you know, we should probably just shoot this. So we got permission and then we just shot their discussion at the table there in the restaurant and then got a shot of them kind of walking out of the building saying goodbye. And that's how we were able to bridge the gap to our, and then we just interviewed them out there with like Moscow downtown in the background. That worked out pretty good, but it was neat to be able to put that together and not have to kind of force that other shot. Because it was like, how do you know, you really want to set it up. And there's a lot of cliches in this business about how to do it. The walking shot. Oh, let's do the walking shot. So, all right, so what do? We have to bring some students over here now and have them, like, meet them randomly on the trail that goes by the – it's just kind of weird. You know, you're trying to make all these connections about how you have this B-roll that you may or may not even use. But if you do use it, you want to have it and set it up correctly. So it just was way more smooth and better than us trying to force this other
thing. Well, and I guess that's a lesson. That's a lesson in experience of you being out on enough stories to know. Because when you start, you go, oh, yeah, I got to have this, this, this. And then you're like, I never use any of that. Why did I shoot that? Why do I waste my time? I need it this way. Instead, you know, I mean, you think of, you kind of develop what your style and the way you want to tell. It's like, I'm going to shoot everything about this piece of paper.
Yeah.
And then you shoot a whole disc on that, and you're like, I don't need that piece of paper. That doesn't tell me anything about the story.
So there's definitely a lot of waste in this industry, but that's just because you're trying to get to the best moments of something, and you might have an idea of something, and it doesn't maybe pan out visually as well as you wanted, but then you discover, hey, there was this other thing, and like this cool thing happened in here that really sets it out. So we'll actually use this. So, you know, it's just the way it is.
Well, and it's discovering a story where you think, okay, I'm going for this. And then you just kind of start listening, and you're like, wait a minute, what was that? Say that again. And when you go into it with an open mind, you sometimes can find out, you know, I kind of don't always like to do a pre-interview. I kind of know what my basis is because I don't want you to say it. I want you to say it as naturally and explain it to me the first time, because chances are if I have some knowledge of what it is that you're going to talk about or know what your phraseology is or your talking points, I might take that in the question and ruin a very good answer. And so I like to just play just inquisitor about, you know, what it is. And to me, it's the follow-up because I'm really trying to listen to what you're saying. Now, okay, so tell me, you were just talking about the restaurant. Yeah. Why is it why do you think they were more comfortable? You know, I mean, that would be, you know, I always think, that's why I think this interview that we do on this discussion and the podcast always is, I know generally what you're doing. And the whole concept was, like, you've turned to me like four times today. Hey, well, there was this one part. And there was this. I just realized, you know what? That's, I think, people are interested in about what it is, because then it's also, you're processing already, you're making edits. Oh, yeah, Steve and I did this one thing where we went and shot downtown, and you know, it didn't work because we were in front of this insurance building, and but we did this thing with the microscope, and it was way cool.
Yeah, that was great.
And so then that to me is kind of how hopefully it helps get the best story possible.
We've talked about that before, too, just about your questioning, and you really like Dan Patrick, and I think that you had some of the advice from him that was like, whatever your question is, chop that in half.
Yeah, chop it in half.
Yeah, and I've noticed that from going to other media things, too. It's like this whole story comes out of the person asking the question, and then eventually they get around to the question. And it's and I don't know if that's a device for other forms of media or not, you know, if that helps them to edit stuff. But yeah, it's like, wow. I don't think you get very spontaneous answers. Like you were talking about with the follow-ups, those are the ones where you get the real answers, because they'll say something and then your follow-up is, why's that? It's not an elaborate question. It's just like, and they say a lot more because you're not so specific. Mm-hmm. So you just get better information that way, I think.
And we're dealing in a niche. And the people who watch the show and the stories and care about the show and the stories, they have a topical understanding of most everything we talk about. Where we make our money is the nuance, the detail that a 4 to 6 minute story allows, and a lot of that comes from the why and the how. Now, how do you do that? Process. Whereas when you get 90 seconds, I just watched a story the other night. It was a political story with one candidate or something being late. I think the reporter got at most 70 seconds to tell you about that event and that story. And I'm like, well, how do you ever get a good answer? Now, part of our world, I understand, is in 140 to 280 characters at a time. I get that. But there is still something to be said about the expanded knowledge and that you're allowed to dig out and flush out.
Yeah, let's do all of our stuff in the longer ones and keep all the political stuff 70 seconds.
You know? Yeah, people enjoy
it. Maybe we'll be more content and happy not having to listen to those sorts of things all the time. I don't know.
All right. Well, anything else on the story in Idaho before we go?
Well, I tell you what. One of the neatest things about it all is that we like to shoot scenics to establish where we're at. And we were able to do that there. And they have this region in between Washington and Idaho that's called the Palouse region. And in French, I think it just means grassland. But it's all hilly and covered in wheat.
Hmm.
It's just little sloping hills. I mean, Google it. It's just, it's an interesting landscape. No trees around. When we drove from Ephrata to Pullman, we eventually came up on it, and we came up over a hill, and it just opened up. And Steve and I were just both kind of like, wow, this is pretty scenic. So we were trying to find some place to pull over. There really wasn't any shoulder. And by the time we found one, it was past where the cool shot was. So we did find out that there was a mountain around there, 3,600 feet high, Steptoe Butte. And we were able to go up there and shoot from there to show the whole area. And so they were doing some planting. And you could see for a long ways just all the dust that was kicked up in the trail. So you could follow them just throughout this whole area where we're at. It was like, oh, they're planting over there. They're planting over there. Planting over there. It was really neat. And we were able to fly in a plane, actually, too.
Oh.
Someone offered us a plane ride, and so we went up and got some shots of from the air, too. So it was just pretty impressive.
The business office is going to ask, did you get pre-approval on the flight? No, that's a whole nother story. Andrew Bott at some point.
I want to cut that part out.
Andrew Bott is at some point going to sit in your seat, and I am going to ask him about the infamous helicopter ride in his career.
Oh, I've heard about them from Steve, too.
Yeah. So, well,
there's always a little bit of an adventure that can unfold on market-to-market stories.
You just never know until you go out and start looking around and you find out how beautiful the country is and how friendly the people are pretty much anywhere you go when you get outside of the city.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Without a doubt.
All right. That's Josh Bittner. Thank you so much, Josh.
Thanks, Paul.
That'll do it for this edition of the MTOM Podcast, a production of Iowa Public Television and the Market to Market TV show. Hey, we'd really like a 5-star review. And if you have an episode that you like that you think somebody else might, share it with them and hit subscribe. Tell a friend. Really love it. And also, by the way, we have some cool stuff coming your way soon. Be watching our Twitter feed and Instagram feed for ways that you can support this program and get thanked for your work. For Josh Bittner, I'm Paul Yeager. Have a great week.